older than me. And then I have a sister 4 years younger and a sister 8 years younger who are still both running amok. And, you know, that life has taken a toll on their bodies and their minds and their spirits. And it is what it is. And I try to love them as the best of my ability. My brother lives in Oregon. And I finally was able to reconnect with him this summer. And what, you know, my little fantasy mind would consider an organic family experience. And it was really cool. And my boys got to meet their uncle and I got to meet my nephews. And my boys are 16, 18, and 20. So my parents were married and divorced to each other 5 times. They would get married, have a kid, get divorced, get married, have a kid, and get divorced. And that's literally what happened. Before my dad passed away, he lived back with my mom probably the last 6, 8 years, 10 years of his life, something like that. And they fought with each other every day. And I think they couldn't love each other and they couldn't not be with each other. And I don't know what weird codependent cycle was going on there, but you know, it's just, it is what it is. So I grew up in a very chaotic home. We grew up Jehovah's Witnesses. I joke and I tell people all the time, you know, and this, there, you know, it's a joke, but there's a little truth to it that, you know, on Saturday and Sunday morning, you know, we sold Watchtower and Awake, and in the evening we sold your drug of choice. You know, we were just a full service spiritual experience family, you know, depending on which end of the spectrum you were interested in. And so, again, one of the inappropriate humor stuff, but anyway, it was the final divorce when I was 12, 13, that things really changed. I knew my mom, she was an angry person. She was very, very abusive. I can look back and see all this pain that she didn't know how to deal with or what to do, or just the unchecked, what do we call it? Dry drunk emotions, right? You know, that all the pain that she lived in. And so, we were definitely the punching bag for that. The abuse never came from my father. My mom was the abusive one. My mom abused my father. She abused my sister. She abused myself. My brother had moved out and away by that time. And so it was just a really abusive home. You know, my sisters and I would hide like the fireplace little sets, you know, because my mom would beat people with it, or she would shoot guns off in the house, or things along those lines. So you just grow up in chaos. But at the same time, we were very active in the religion, in the Kingdom Hall, and we had to put on that front, you know? So there would be chaos usually getting to church, and then everybody would smile and nod when you get there, and then you get back home and it's, you know, chaos. And it was just a very conflicting place to grow up in. The divorce, final divorce happens. I think I watched, you know, I say this as a 46-year-old single mom now. I watched a woman really try to do what she needed to do to support 3 kids, you know, and we lived in poverty, and I'm not going to say that in a bad way. I remember I used to think that people that had brick houses or bricks in their homes were rich, you know, or, you know, if you had air conditioners in every room, you were rich. We had those funky little swamp coolers that just blew in hot, watery air, you know, and it was just miserable. And so I tell people right now, I'd give up food before I give up air conditioning. and so I watched her for a year or so really try to do it on her own. I don't think I understood what she was experiencing, but I knew I watched my mom work 2 and 3 jobs to try to take care of kids. She met a guy who I'm sure provided some relief to her. And that changed the dynamics of our family. I mean, it seemed like we went from mom working 2 and 3 jobs and always being at the Kingdom Hall to drug central and everybody doing drugs or drinking or partying. And it wasn't just our home. It was like our whole neighborhood. You know, there's not a kid alive today that lived in the immediate 3 streets that I grew up with. They all died of alcoholism, addiction, overdose, violence, things, anything that this disease brings into our lives. Not one kid that I grew up with lived, which is kind of amazing. Don't get me wrong. I have some best friends that I met like in high school that were still friends, but the people that lived in my immediate community, we didn't know it was different, right? Like, I think we knew that internally something wasn't right, but everybody's doing it. It's your normal. you know, you see parents and kids partying together and all those kind of things. And so it quickly became our normal. The guy that my mom was dating is actually still in prison right now. He'll be in prison for the rest of his life because he murdered a lot of people. I grew up in a cartel type of environment. And when I say that, I'm not joking. I'm just telling the truth of what it is. And so I was telling a therapist this story one day, and she's like, Amanda, you can't tell this to people. You're going to give them post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was like, this is probably the only place I can be honest about my story, because people usually look and be like, oh, poor you, or what is this? And I'm like, now, like, I know I needed every one of those experiences to become who I am today, you know? But if I'm giving y'all anything, just wave a flag and I can try to tone it down or, you know, edit it a little bit. It's just the reality of my life. my mom was the first to introduce my sisters to their drug of choice, which is heroin. And they were 9 and they were 13 when they became heroin addicts. And they continue to be a part of that life to this day. At 14, I was playing house with a grown man. I thought I was very grown up and you know, it was good to go. And it was better than being at home. But I don't think that I thought that. I knew I felt safe. I know a lot of people raise an eyebrow about it. And as a woman, I do today too. And as a mother, I certainly do. But it was a person who was good to me in its twistedness, you know? And so I kind of have sometimes mixed feelings about all that. I have at that time I didn't find it necessary. So my youngest sister has a 5th grade education. My mom told her that she died from cancer and they just took them off the radar, you know? I went to like my first week of 9th grade and I decided I had better things to do. And so that was at that point in my life, you know, the extent of my education. And then at 17, I decided that I couldn't be a part of this world anymore. I became very judgmental of it. I became very judgmental of what my mom was allowing to happen in our home to my sisters. My sisters, you know, this is one thing people are going to get sober when they want to get sober. But I damn sure get some of the trauma people have to overcome to get sober. You know, and I have a lot of compassion for that because we genuinely don't know what else somebody has experienced in their heart and their soul and their mind and their upbringing. And so I have a whole lot of compassion. I don't have a lot of tolerance for using it as an excuse to continue to destroy your life, but I have endless compassion for what got you there. I kind of have been able to kind of create that line of the two. 17, I decided that I needed to be an adult. And so, I grew up in survival world, like the rules just didn't apply. And sometimes I still struggle with coloring inside the lines. I found out that you could go to Arkansas, which was where my dad lived, and you could have a preacher sign on a Bible, your date of birth, and make an insurance form or bring an insurance form, which I made on the computer and brought it up there, and you'll get a driver's license. So I had my uncle, who wasn't a preacher, but, you know, signed the Bible saying this was my date of birth. And I made the form and went and got my Arkansas driver's license, brought it back to Texas. And I was all of a sudden 20. So I could get my own apartment. I got my first job at a fancy dress store in the rich part of Dallas. And I became their top salesperson quickly because, one, I was just so full of shit. And all I knew how to do was lie and manipulate people that, of course, I was going to be the best salesperson that store had ever seen. You know, women, we're easy to read, you know, we want to hear that we're beautiful and loved and that there's nobody better than us. And I would tell that to every one of my customers. And so they loved me and I did wonderful. And I really distanced myself from my family. It took me a long time to understand because I carried a lot of guilt around abandoning my sisters, you know, to an environment that I had a lot of disdain for. They were neck deep in an environment. I couldn't have pulled them out if I wanted to. And so for several years, there was no family contact other than the occasional somebody's in rehab, somebody's in detox, somebody's overdosed. And I just didn't have any space for them. You know, I literally, I know that this is a harsh term, but I viewed our entire family as white trash, and I wasn't going to be white trash anymore. I was going to go make something out of myself. And I remember the day I decided that. It was in, so during the ninth grade, the 2 weeks that I went, my best friend, who is still a best friend to this day, she went to another magnet school on the other side of downtown Dallas. So I would skip my classes and go sit in her class. And we went one day to tour the downtown library, and like all the women council people or whatever were there, and they were all dressed up in suits, and you know, they were respected and people were seeing them. Like, I remember this vividly, and I was like, that's what I'm going to do, right? Like, that's who I need to become. And I don't know what I was trying to overcome. You know, I just guess, I think I bought into that white picket fence fantasy that when you have that, you know, that's the ultimate reality. That's the American dream, right? But I remember that. And so that led to just this kind of drive to be successful. And successful to me meant money. You know, that's exactly what it meant to me. And I did very well in every job. I went into sales and I excelled in every element of that. At 21, I was out and about. We would play games as girls, like whoever could get the most phone numbers could drink free that night, you know? And so we were always competing, not that we were interested in the guys. We were just seeing whose phone numbers we could get. Stupid stuff kids do, or my friends and I did. And ended up meeting this guy. He was smart. I loved that. He was so smart. And fast forward a couple of years, we're together and I'm pregnant, and that scared the living hell out of me. But I'm going to make it work, right? Because I'm not going to be a single mom. I'm not going to be a statistic. You know, I think I was very, it was kind of an amazing thing that I even, looking back at who I was and just how obtuse of an individual I was, even that moment, I knew it was wrong because we were kind of, let me say this real quick. I was planning a wedding. he was along for the ride. And the minute I found out I was pregnant, I didn't want any of it anymore. I knew, oh, wow, I really am stuck with this person, right? I think that I was more looking for security than I was companionship. And Lord knows I didn't know about any of the things. I didn't know anything about relationships or companionship or friendship even. I wasn't good at any of those things. I think with the exception of the people that are still my best friends to this day, I took advantage of any human being that came in front of me. I don't think that I knowingly said, oh, I'm going to take advantage of them. I just thought that's what you did to people, right? That's, people are just objects to be, to meet my needs, plain and simple. And so we have a kid. Then he decides we really need to get married. He was a very successful individual. His family was a very successful family. And, you know, I don't think they were too fond of him bringing the little uneducated, you know, not up to their standard girl home. And not only did he bring her home, they brought her home pregnant. And so it was never a good kind of dynamic from the get-go, but I swear I wanted so bad. And I think I turned myself inside out trying to make something that was never going to work. Very wealthy. So here I am at, you know, 23, 24 year old running around in St. John. And I don't know if y'all are fashion labels, but that's not necessarily a 23 year old line of clothing. You know, it's for people my age now, you know, I'd be love to have some St. John today, you know, but I look at all those things. I tried to become his mom. You know, my Christmas tree looked like hers. I didn't know what all these things should look like. So I figure if I just do what she does, then I will begin to kind of fit into this world. And the more I tried to fit in, just the worse internally I got. I'm going to say this because I think it's important. And this is my story, and I'm not trying to bring outside issues in, but I am a therapist today. Actually, I got my GED at 35, and don't get me wrong. I tried to go to school and lie, say, and this is like 6 months into starting my program, and say I didn't have, say I had my high school diploma, but college checked. And so I had to go back and get a GED. So God was like, no, we're going to do this right the whole way. We're going to learn honesty in the most humiliating form of life possible. Sometimes I'm thankful that I didn't grow up in a world of mental health awareness. And I don't know if because I'm in it, it's hyper aware to me, but I think I would have been diagnosed all the things. And when I look back, when I run across families that I have an opportunity to work with, I really try not to go to diagnosing people because we really are doing the best we can in some sick situations, and we're surviving. And that's going to look, like this, or it's going to look like this. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm mentally sick, right? Usually for most of us, it means we're spiritually sick and we need to begin to learn new ways to look at ourselves. And so I that's been one way I've been able to give myself a lot of compassion because I made a lot of mistakes. And I think that that's important. I know I bring that up because it was always a button for me. He would always kind of call me, you're crazy. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that I wasn't acting crazy, right? I definitely had some crazy ability. I still do. It keeps my boys in check. As a matter of fact, they're big old boys. And they're like, I have a little healthy fear of mom because she knows she's a little on the edge. And so, we're moving forward with marriage and I'm miserable. I began physically altering my body to look. I began to have lots of plastic surgeries to look a certain way, thinking that if I looked this way and became this way, that maybe then I could be a part of this world, that then I would be accepted, then I would be loved, then I would be needed, or whatever it was that I was looking for. Like 3 months after I got like a tummy tuck from the first kid, I found out I was pregnant with the second one, but we were also having a wedding. So let me rephrase that. I found out the day we got home from our honeymoon that I was like 6 days pregnant, which was really, a strange way to find out that I was sick when we got back. And so here I am finding myself pregnant again. I know that with my first son, who I love my boys endlessly, I was terrified the whole time. I did not want to be attached to this world, to this family, to this, facade that I knew it like inside, but I wasn't listening to it, right? I was just working harder and harder, but I became more miserable and sicker and sicker. Get married, come back, my boys are all 18 months apart. they told me that I would never have a kid, so I got one kid on birth control pills. I had another kid on a Depo-Provera shot, and I had another kid after my tubes were tied. And so I kind of always feel like God wanted all my children. and so they were meant to be here. Bishop, who is my youngest, who's 16 today, it was the worst. With my second pregnancy, I have a lot of compassion for people who are suicidal. I've never been a suicidal person, but I was so miserable that at that moment in my life, suicide made more, and I didn't attempt it. It was just a thought that was in my head, all the time. Like, I can't keep doing this. I don't want to be here, And I wanted to be here, right? Like, I wanted the fantasy. I had everything I wanted. I had all more money, not only from his money, but mine. I was doing very well in my business. I was such a brat. I had a car for every day of the week. And believe me, if I met y'all, I'd have told y'all that. I'm driving Monday's car, right? Or I'm driving Tuesday's car. I mean, I was such an asshole. I can't even believe people spoke to me, I was just a brat. And I had everything that I thought I was supposed to have to be happy. And I think that I was more miserable with each and every passing day. So birth Bishop, 7 months later, I had my first affair. There was no communication between him and I. There was nothing really between he and I other than coexisting, raising kids. And so I would say probably for the next year, I would go out of town with my girlfriends and, it's easy to find people to meet at a bar and hook up or whatever, right? That's kind of what I would call an affair. However, it was December 23rd and I was at home and I met some girlfriends out for like a little friends Christmas, you know, night out. And I met a guy across the bar and he waved and blew a kiss and he looked good. And he was leaving to go on, out of town and go into the army on January 12th. And come January 12th, he doesn't go because he's in love. And, you know, it's a passionate exchange those 2 weeks that he's here and it's fun and it's exciting. And he's saying all the right things and he's doing all the right things. And he is taking me right back to the language of my family's love dynamic. So it feels familiar. It feels like love, right? When I always say the book talks about, you know, that our life becomes normal, right? You know, living in this fantasy world, now that I look back on it, you know, it was very abnormal to me. It was very dry. It was very sterile. You know, I was accustomed to chaos and yelling and making up and, you know, extreme emotional, you know, I was still in extreme emotion. I mean, poor guy, sometimes I look at him like what he must have put up with me. And I know it takes two sides to tango in a relationship, but poor guy, I mean, he held it in for a long time. You know, it's real easy for me to look at what I experienced, you know, in that fifth step, it was a little bit harder to look at what I had caused others to experience, you know. And it even took me a long time to be honest about what I had caused others to experience. But so it enters Michael, and it all happened so fast. 5 months later, I had moved out of my home and I'm setting up shop with this new guy and he is the one. And, you know, there were a couple little things that bothered me, but, you know, he'd go disappear for a couple days here and there and, you know, I wouldn't hear from him. And, you know, but I would just go play mommy for those days, or I would go back home because I've so needed someone to fill that space, right? And I think because my husband at the time, we weren't divorced yet, I think he realized, okay, ooh, we're in deep shit here. You know what I mean? He would just allow it. And I took advantage of the situation for a long time. So every time Michael would go, and what I now know is little weekend binges, which turned into one big long binge, you know, over the course of the relationship. I would run back to John and, you know, pretend that I was interested the whole time, obsessing about what Michael's doing. Where is he at? You know, how do I find him? What do I do? And, you know, I can really skim over this part, but I think it's really important. Especially for Al-Anon, because we think we're doing the right thing. I would go pull Michael out of places at 2 o'clock in the morning with my kids asleep in the back of the car. Right? I would scream and yell and scream and yell when he disappeared. You know, I've never been a physical mom. I wasn't going to hit my kids. I spanked my oldest son one time at 10 years old. And I still apologize to him for that to this day. You know, he's like, what, you going to beat me, mom? And I'm like, yeah, yeah, I am. You know, it's like a little joke because it wasn't a beating. Don't get me wrong. But they would flinch because, you know, I was loud and I was a yeller and I was a bully. As a matter of fact, my first journal entry that my sponsor had me write out was to look up the word bully and to look up the word mother. And I don't think I called my sponsor for like 3 weeks after that. And there's a whole story about that one. If we have time for it, remind me and I'll tell you, because it just shows you how sick I was. You know, I brought and I created so much tension in my home. And I thank God every day that my boys were little when all this was going on, because they barely remember most of it. And I'm very, very thankful for that. You know, I tried to make a home with someone who was reeling in alcoholism and an addiction. And I didn't know then that it just can't work, right? I did not know that, I didn't know then what I know today, the same thing that most of us know today. And I tried. I would make sure I knew where he was at. And if I thought he was lying to me, I would call everybody around him to see where he was at. And if he was telling me the truth, right? Like, I got some grade A stalking skills. I would find jobs for him because he couldn't hold a job. Sorry. I would pay his bills before I would pay his pay my bills. I can't tell you how many times that I put up bond for him that ultimately I ended up paying all of them on my own. After after I got into the program, that was my responsibility. I signed for those, whether I signed for them because I believed this time it was going to be different or not. Ultimately, I made the decision to sign for those things. I'll tell you, I think I hated everyone and everything, but simultaneously loved everyone and everything for the first year or two in recovery. Kind of coming to terms with myself was not a pleasant experience. And not being able to blame it on anyone but myself anymore wasn't a pleasant experience. You know, I could meet any one of you and tell you how horrible my mom was. And of course, you're going to feel sorry for me, right? And you're going to validate whatever I need to hear from you at that moment. Or what a horrible experience I have with, you know, not only my ex-husband, but, you know, this guy that I'm so in love with. And I mean, you know, what's really sad about this disease, I love me some alcoholics. You still to this day, because I'm single, put me in a room with 50 guys and I'm going to pick the active alcoholic. I love, love, love them. Their ability to love is unlike anything I have ever experienced. You know, and the book talks about that Jekyll and Hyde. It's the truth. When they're on point, there is no better human being on the face of the earth. It's addictive in and of itself. And when things are not good, things are not good. And it's the same with my sisters. And I've never seen sobriety from them. I've seen, you know, medically assisted treatments, you know, that give them some balance in life. But even that improves, you know, and kind of brings their spark back some, you know. And so... I believed him every time it was the last time, and no different than the book says. I think he believed, and I think he wanted it to be the last time, whatever it was, you know, and our relationship got toxic, I would say, after about the last year of it. I learned that if he was going to hurt me, I was going to hurt him. And so I would push his buttons in any way that I could. And that doesn't create for a positive environment. And our relationship turned physical. And with my ex-husband, the most angry he'd ever got with me, he was making chocolate milk for one of our kids and he just squirted the chocolate syrup. And I remember, you know, shooting all in the air and the ceiling. And that's the most angry the man had ever been with me. And I get to the point to where I don't think if I had met my sponsor the moment that I did, I think one of us would have killed each other. I think we were kind of at that point that our relationship had gotten so toxic. You know, I talk to a lot of women that when I'm working with them and they're like, but they wouldn't really hurt me. Well, no, I don't believe that they would intentionally hurt you. But I think that when they're in a blackout drunk or they're on a meth binge for 5 or 6 days and they don't know if they're in their right mind or they're straight up psychotic and delusional, that they know what they're doing. Yeah, those are the moments that you get hurt. And when you get a mouthy loudmouth like me, who first and foremost doesn't understand that it's really that serious, right? Because I am in such denial that I can't accept the reality right in front of me, right? I can't accept that things are this bad. And I remember that as things were progressing, I kept thinking, I don't want to end up like my mom, like I'm turning into my mom. And to this day, that one is still a little button, you know, that pushes me. I've been much of a homebody lately. And my mom, probably the last 5 years of her house, all she did was sit there and watch TV. And even this morning, I was sitting downstairs. Now I have fever and all that, but I'm talking about during COVID. I don't go do anything. I sit downstairs and I watch TV or I'm up here on my Zoom working. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm turning into my mom. And so I still have one of those little weird fears, you know, brewing inside of me. But, you know, there was my life had gotten, by the time Al-Anon's about to enter, I didn't know the true from the false anymore, right? The book talks about we can no longer differentiate the truth from the false, right? I wanted to believe them. I knew that they were lying. I knew what I was seeing wasn't adding up. I knew that I had crossed into lines of places that I don't belong anymore. I knew that I didn't want to drag my children through these things. I knew that I wouldn't you know, their dad is a trauma doc, so he would be like 3 or 4 days on and 3 or 4 days off. And so, you know, we just kind of kept an open little visitation where when he wasn't working, he could have the boys. And I know that there were times that I was in such not physical good shape as a result of the night before his argument that I wouldn't go pick up my kids because I didn't want them to see that. Nor did I want anybody else to see that because it carries so much shame, right? And you have to hide it and all the fears that come with those things, you know? And Al-Anon, we're the group that's going to come across the women who are, and men, who are experiencing the anger of the sick individual. And I think it's real important that we're compassionate to them and understand like the shame, hold them accountable. They're not, you know, people aren't going to change till they want to change, but to not shame them in their space, you know, to me, that's a really important way that I work with women, you know, because if I don't make it safe for them to come and be who they are and share what they're experiencing, well, why are they going to, right? If we're not a loving, welcoming environment, regardless of the chaos, because all of our chaos landed us in this room, regardless of whether it's mild, medium, or hot chaos, right? It's chaos that landed us here. He was in and out of treatment, you know, and by this time I was kind of engaging with my family a little bit. I had arranged for my sisters to go to treatment a couple of times. They never asked me to help them in any way, shape, form, or fashion. You know, I just was going to save them. And I don't think that was my intent that I was going to be their savior, but we can't have this anymore. You know, things are not good. You know, this is my sister's and blah, 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 blah. And I have all this money and I can fix it. And I did the same thing with him. And, you know, by this time I had kind of two things I was doing. My business was kind of self-supporting. I had staff over there that was taking care of it. And then I was working at a nonprofit. And don't get me wrong, I love nonprofit work. I also know that my motives at that time were it made me look good to be in, I was executive director for Meals on Wheels in Denton County. And there we would do these little community fair things. And so sometimes I would go by and meet people. And I remember seeing these poster boards for this one little funky company. I didn't know what the hell they were. I didn't know what a sober living home was, right? But they had these poster boards up where it would show people like their jail picture and their sober picture kind of side by side. And it literally looked like a science project, right? Like this, how poor they were. And they're like, we can get your loved one treatment for $600 a month. And I'm like, I can afford that. You know what I mean? Like that's something I can afford. And so, Michael and I had had one final moment and, he had come home really, really drunk and, I was mouthing off as usual. And, he began choking me and I was screaming and yelling. And my son, who was 5 at the time, walked downstairs carrying like a little lightsaber sword. And I remember before I passed out saying a little prayer, like, God, don't let this man hurt my kid. Right. And I know that next morning when I woke up, I was like, I can't be here anymore. But I was so bound to fear. I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to abandon them. And I'll tell you, this is something I have seen with every woman that I've had the opportunity to work with when it's a partner relationship. I didn't want to have to put all the hard work in for another woman to come along and get the good Michael. You know what I mean? Like I wouldn't let him go because I just knew that that's when he was going to be magically cured and the next woman was going to get the good Michael. Talk about selfish, right? Like, I would rather him stay an addict than another woman get a sober Michael. But I didn't know that then, right? Like, I didn't understand just how effed my brain was. The next day we went to church. We're thinking this is funny because this is a learned behavior and we were fighting the whole way prior to, and we walk in and we're smiling and nodding. And let me be clear. We didn't join one church because what I would do within 5 miles of my home, half of the mega churches in Texas that exist are within 5 miles of my home. And within a mile of my home, there's probably 10. So I would look up and see what sermons were going on. And I would determine which one he needed to hear. And that's the church we would go to that Sunday because we needed to save him, right? And so that's what was going to do it. And I remember standing there like during the song part and I was digging my heels into his foot. And there was a part of me, and I remember this, and I removed my foot and my shoe and I was like, man, to quit being this person. Like, this is just horrible. This is not who you are. I think for the first time in my life, I said a prayer that I actually meant. And I was like, because I all the time would say, God, give me a sign. Like, should I be with Michael? And then he wouldn't come home for 4 days. I mean, if that's not a hell of a sign, I don't know what is, but it wasn't the sign I wanted, right? Like, you know, it wasn't clear enough. And I remember driving across this bridge one time, being angry as all get out with God. And there's, you know, like a little Trinity River underneath it, and thinking, okay, God, you know, you parted a damn ocean for Moses. Like, just make a little ripple and I'll know that you're real, right? Because by this point, I didn't know what was real and what was not real anymore, right? I didn't know what was wrong with my prayers not good enough. Why wasn't I getting answered? You know, there's something not right here. But I think I said one of those, just, I don't know if you call them moments of defeat. I wouldn't call it a moment of clarity. I would call it a moment of surrender. And I was like, God, I need to know what to do here. And so we were going home, and we always had Sunday, because I was going to keep the charade up, Sunday dinner. And he said he was going to go to the store and get cigarettes and be back. And I knew he wouldn't be back. And I also knew I wasn't going to let him back in. And I didn't know how that would happen. And I didn't hear from him for 3 or 4 weeks anyway. And I didn't stalk. Don't get me wrong, I couldn't sleep. My anxiety was through the roof. At that time, I smoked, and I was probably smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And I didn't know how I was going to go forward. I lost 15 pounds during that month because I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I barely took care of my children, because when people ask if the obsession in Al-Anon, I think it's just as powerful. I say we are exactly the same as them. My obsession is just them. And in reality, my obsession is just me. You know, I need them to do what I need them to do so I can be okay. I'm worried about me. Now I'm worried about them, and I'm worried about them, but I'm worried about me. I'm orchestrating this whole life to make me comfortable, because I don't know how to be uncomfortable. I don't know how to sit with my emotions. Shit, I don't even know what an emotion is. You know what I know? I know anger. I know rage. I don't know fear, because I can handle anybody that comes my way, you know, like at that point in my life. I know shame, but I'm sure as hell not going to say it. I know unworthy, but I'm not going to let anybody know that I know that. I don't know that up until 5 years ago, I even had an inkling of a clue what true love meant. And that's 5 years into a program. And so I didn't know how to move forward. I was falling apart. And so one day I'm at this next little community fair thing. I see that funky poster again, and I'm like, you know what? That's where I'm going to take him. We're going to try one last time. So he comes over for lunch, or what was supposed to be lunch, because I was such an honest individual. You know what's amazing too, is I would have told anybody I met that I was honest, but it's because I wasn't able to look at my dishonest ways to point out your dishonesty, you know? And so, excuse me. Oh, that hurts. We pull up because their office was in this funky old church that was donated to him. When I'm saying funky old church, it had like purple trim. It was just a funky little sad building, but I love it so much. I think he realizes more what's going on than I do, or than I thought he did. He would, and he takes off running down the street, and two guys who are 12-step guys come outside. It's a 12-step based sober living. I didn't know anything about all this. And then a woman comes outside, and she, you know, asked me to come inside, and I'm just falling apart in her office because, see, I need him to be sober because I don't know what to do anymore. Like, my plans have failed. You know, I've failed at a marriage. I'm failing at this relationship. I've broken my kids' hearts, you know. I can't do anything right. I am falling apart. And I'm not playing when I say that, guys. I probably needed to be put up for a couple days because I just couldn't manage my own anything. All I could do was cry and smoke cigarettes and be anxious. And I think that there was about 3 weeks that I didn't even go get my kids because I didn't know what to do. I couldn't manage taking care of them, because I couldn't not focus on what was going on over here. I needed to solve it. And it was just going and going and going in my head, right? And so this woman, she brings me in her office and I'm crying and what's going to happen? And by this time he comes back. So those two guys, I guess, are 12th stepping him at that moment. You know, I have no clue what happened outside, but she looks at me and she asks me if I wanted to be okay. And I told her in not nice words, you know, how can I be okay? Can you not see, you know, what's going on? And she's like, look, if you want to be okay, just call me tomorrow and I'll show you how to be okay. And I don't know what happened. I don't know why I called her. And then she said, well, if you really want to be okay, come to meet me at this place on Friday. And I went and I met. And I went and met a bunch of people that looked like you. And I hated every one of you because you were laughing. And then y'all had me hold your funky germ-ridden hands and say these weird chants at ends of meetings, right? And y'all laughed about all your kids that were, you know, oh, they used to get high. And I'm back here bawling my eyes out. And I'm like, this isn't funny at all. What the hell is wrong with you psychotic people? I was expecting to swallow a frog at any moment. But you know what I had? I was desperate. And to me, that is the most beautiful gift that we can get in this program. I was desperate. And alcohol, what does the book talk about, is a great persuader. It beat me into a state of reasonableness. And my best attempts landed me more miserable than I'd ever been in my entire life. And I became willing to listen. I was through the steps in 5 weeks, which is what I do with all my girls. I personally am not a step of the month club because I'm telling you, he and I would have killed each other if I would have done a step of the month club membership. And I'm not knocking that. We each have our own path. I'm just saying for me, I was sick when I got here. What is one of those movies? They call it a stage five clinger. I was a stage five clinger. And so my fifth step pissed me off, and having to wait an hour afterwards pissed me off even more because I had a date that night. I don't know. I went from despair to, you know, a couple Al-Anon meetings to going and having a date because he was going to fix it for me. Like this new guy was going to fix it, you know? And so, then she had me start on amends, you know, immediately. I'm doing all these things. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm going through the motion. And I remember driving home from one of my amends. And my amends is where my awakening occurred, right? Because I didn't want to hear that it wasn't my fault because my entire identity revolved around me being a victim, right? The very fabric of my being was created from somebody doing me wrong. And I had to learn how to not only own all that stuff, when I had to learn to be honest. I didn't know how to be honest. I didn't know what honesty was. You know, the program says that all we need to be doing is willing and to try. I was willing to learn to try to be honest. And that was enough, right? That was enough for God to say, okay, this crazy, pathetic, hot mess of a child of mine is sincerely trying to the best of her ability. I'm gonna throw her a bone. And then you just continue to go forward and you continue to go forward. And it was the amends where my awakening took place. I remember this, and I hope I don't ever forget it. I was 6 months into my program. My sponsor would tell me to sit the hell down, and she was a very bossy sponsor, and she was exactly what I needed. Because apparently I wasn't successful at designing my life. Right? And I really began to see the damage I caused. I can tell you for probably a year after the fifth step became real to me, which was very kind of mixed all in that 5 weeks, but the awakening, I'll never forget that moment, came in coming home from an amends. But thinking about all the horrible things I had said to my sisters, right? All the horrible things I had said to other people, all the ways I had manipulated and harmed people and me trying to get my needs met, all the lies that came out of my mouth, all the horrible things I did to try to make sure that my comfort was met, right? And I bet I mourned that stuff for a solid year. I had such a fear of never wanting to hurt another human being again that I didn't know what to do with people. I didn't know. One, there's nothing I can do with them that's going to make them okay. As a matter of fact, most part, my sponsors used to tell me that I could talk about the weather and I could talk about sports because those are the only two things I'm not going to have an opinion on because I don't know crap about sports and we're all going to agree on the opinion of the weather. And those were the only two topics that I could talk to people about. And she was right, right? Because in my broken, hot messness of a life, I would try to tell everybody else what they were supposed to be doing, right? Or I would use my victim story. I didn't know how to have a conversation. I didn't know how to be a real person. I didn't have an identity. My identity had been consumed in being whatever anybody else had needed me to be at that moment in their life, or whatever I needed to be to get what I wanted from you. Right? I was a great little chameleon. I would be whatever the moment called for. And so at 6 months, though, I'm into the program. I'm sitting at home with my kids and I'm content. That's the first time in my whole life, too, I had ever felt contentment. And that is a feeling that I guard above all things in my life now. It's just, it's a content space. But we were playing a game and we were all laughing. And it really caught me off guard because it had been so long since there had been laughter in my home. You know, and I would go to a group that, you know, I mean, they don't beat around the bush. There's some big book thumping Al-Anons. Like, this is how we do it, you know, and there's a lot of people with a lot of opinions about the group that I go to, but it was where I needed to be. And they'll always talk about how the terrible tension that grips that alcoholic home. The book even talks about it. But I was the person bringing that tension in. You know, I was the person always amping up the element. And so, you know, when I began to look at all those things, I realized I'm kind of running out of time, so I'm trying to fast forward. But, you know, fast forward a few years later, I still don't date well, right? This is honest, 10 years in. And that's mostly now because I'm too honest, like in the honest, honest way, you know, and I finally learned my worth. And I know what I deserve, and I'm unwilling to settle for things anymore. And I love alcoholics, and I can't do an active alcoholic relationship, even though it's what I love. But, you know, in that time period, that one of the other moments that was the most proud of me is because in my soul, I'd always believed I was worthless, right? When you grow up hearing those things, they become a little bit of truth, and you wear that. Is the day I went and I called my sponsor, and I was like, I'm going to go take my GE today. This is probably a year into the program. And she's like, why are you calling me with that stupid stuff? Go take a damn GED and call me afterwards, right? But to me, like, the whole world was so important on that moment because, like, it determined, can I actually go do these things on my own, right? Can I stand as my own person? And when I got the results back, I have a PhD today. That GED meant more to me than that PhD. And I will tell you, people look at me and they're like, are you kidding me? I'm like, well, the rest of it was just all a bunch of idiot books that I had to read. That GED was the moment that showed me I could actually go do something with myself, you know, that was honest, that didn't involve manipulating other people, right? I've had the opportunity to have my sisters with my relationship with my sisters. We've been able to love each other where we're at. I don't welcome them in my home. I love them with all my heart, but stuff comes up missing. I'm not a fool. But I'll go meet them out, right? I'll go meet them and we'll go have lunch or we'll go do this. And I get to spend time with them. They don't show up that day very personally because 9 times out of 10, they're not going to show up anyway. And so if they do text me and say, hey, where are we meeting? I'm out the door. But 9 times out of 10, they're not going to, you know, and I don't take it personal. Because that's their disease. You know, for many years, I held a lot of things like that in me, or I would be very resentful for people not keeping their word because I was a super honest person, you know. I was able to, you know, take care of my mom the last couple of years of her life. And what that means is I was not able to identify myself through her. I was able to, like, let her have her experience and me have mine and hold boundaries. And my boys got to see, they called her Crazy Mamaw, you know, and they loved her and she loved them. And it was a very guarded and relationship full of boundaries, you know, but I was able to allow those things to happen in our life. You know, I learned to be a friend to women, right? You know, I was the kind of woman who would flirt just because I could, not because I necessarily wanted anything, but I just needed that constant, somebody's looking at me type of crap or whatever it is that goes on in my head, who knew? And I don't do that anymore. I would never do that to another woman today. I didn't understand the hurt that I might have been causing another person, right? I didn't understand there's another set of emotions outside of mine attached to it, you know? I'm able to keep secrets today I really try not to gossip, or I'm very selective about who I gossip with. Let me say that kind of jokingly. If I'm going to say it, I'm going to say it. You know, there, everything I've learned about being a woman, a mother, a parent, an employer, an employee, I learned in these rooms. And I was fortunate enough to be surrounded by women who were not working a program. And I was able to hear how their stories were not what I wanted to do. And they were great teachers for me. And I was fortunate to be around women that were a year ahead of me and 10 years ahead of me and 30 years ahead of me, that were able to push me and guide me and provide me with a place to say, we get it. We know how much it hurts, you know, and move forward in life. You know, I have really close relationships with my sons, and I thank God for that every day of my life. You know, they are good boys, and one of them's struggling right now. And sometimes I wonder, like, where we're going to go, you know, like what's about to happen, but I know no matter what happens. And I think this is probably the thing that's been one of the top 10 most coolest things about the program, is I know not one person belongs to me, whether I gave birth to them, whether I'm married to them, or whether we're related by blood. And I know that if there is a design for my life, that everything that happened was meant to happen, then everything that's happening in their life is what's meant to happen for a plan that's not mine, right? And I think sometimes swallowing that pill that the plan's not mine is the hardest part of the program sometimes. You know, like my son, I want you to be in college. I want you to use this. I want you to have your talents, you know. Well, there might be other lessons for him that have to come, you know, in this life. And I don't get to decide that. And I've had to learn real quick, where am I going to love him right where he's at? Where am I going to have my boundary, you know? But where am I going to love him right where he's at? Because that's what he needs from me, is love. He's going to have to go figure all this stuff out, no matter how much it breaks my heart. Because as soon as I start wondering how much it breaks my heart, I'm back on me. I'm not worried about him, right? I'm right back in selfish mode, only worried about what I want, what I think, what I need, and not trusting this higher power that, one, I didn't even acknowledge for the first 3 years of a program. And then it's taken me years and years to find one that works for me, you know? And I guess, I know I'm out of time. Thank y'all. I just want to say one, if Al-Anon is semi-new to you, find a sponsor, get through the work. That connection is what creates the miracle. Step 12 is what keeps it going. You know, if there were this right here today, I was texting Lisa, you know, Jamie ahead of time. God knew that my little headspace was not good a month ago, that I was going to need to be right here today, you know? And it's really amazing how everything is always perfectly timed. Thank y'all for letting me share my little version of crazy. And it was really nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Amanda. Thank you so much. Sorry, we can't open up a big applause for you. We want to be doing that right now.
Thank you, Amanda.
Okay, we'll close up the meeting, I think. So beautiful. Thank you so much, Amanda. In closing, this group takes a moment to recognize the members who serve the group. Our GR is Cindy F. Our alternate GR and website is Lisa K. Our secretary, Jamie E. Our treasurer, Margo B. And our greeter coordinator, Kelly R. And desire chips. Would anyone like a desire chip? We'll wait for something significant. Okay. In closing, I'd like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who've had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we gave you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out with someone else, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Will all who care to please unmute and join me in the closing of the Lord's Prayer. Together, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Keep coming back.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
Yeah.
Yes, keep coming back.